Team effort. Nehemiah 3. So we're continuing with our series in the book of Nehemiah, and we have come to chapter 3, which is where they start to rebuild the broken down walls of the city. Now, I have to say, this is a very special chapter for me, and I think I mentioned this 2 weeks ago. The reason is, my first ever sermon I preached at HBC was from Nehemiah chapter 3. It was in January 2000, so just over 19 years ago. And I wasn't a minister then, but I was. It's when I just first joined the preaching team. And I must admit, when I was given the text and looked at it, I thought, I'm being stitched up here. Because when you'll find out why in a moment, because when you look at this chapter, it's a list of names and a list of which bits of the wall they built. I thought, oh goodness, what can I possibly do with this text? But actually, as I got into it, it's thrilling. It's a great chapter, and so I hope you feel a little bit thrilled this morning as well as we look at Nehemiah 3. So I want to set the scene again. Who was the first king of Israel? Saul, thank you. Reverend Dr. Neely. Saul. Who was the second king? Who was the third king? And what happened after Solomon? It split into the northern kingdom, which was how many tribes? 10, and the southern kingdom, which was 2. And that was the beginning of the end, in some ways, for Israel. The northern kingdom fell into idolatry, those 10 tribes. They were exiled by the Assyrians in 722 BC. And then the southern kingdom also fell away from God. They were worshipping Baal, making Asherah poles, just going back to their old ways. And so God took his hand of protection. I mean, Israel is a land bridge between three continents, between Africa, Asia, and Europe. So it's going to be a bit vulnerable there. God protected them, but God lifted his hand of protection from them. And the result was they were judged. And they were opposed by the Babylonian kingdom, which succeeded the Assyrian kingdom. And we read that the Babylonians laid siege to Jerusalem for 18 months. Now, that tells you something about Jerusalem. If it was just a little wall, they could have knocked it down. This is the imperial army of Babylon. But they laid siege for 18 months. I think their view was either they will surrender or they will starve to death. They probably didn't care either way. Either way, they would win. Excavations have shown that wall around the city of David was 6 meters thick. Now, that's a lot. I don't know how much 6 meters is. Anyone technical? Is it from me to that wall, do you think? No, I... spatially. Now, you're not going to break through a wall of solid stone that thick in a hurry, are you? Paul, you're looking sceptical. You think it's more up here? Okay. We'll do a little poll later. So, it's thick. So what happened in the end, if I've understood the text correctly, is the Israelites themselves, they were literally starving after 18 months. They made a hole in the wall and they ran out of it. Of course, the Babylonians saw them and caught up with them. And, you know, it can't be hard to chase people who haven't eaten for a year and a half. And they overtook them and defeated them, put out the king's eyes and they took them off to exile. So I'm going to show this slide again with the we're not there yet. So that was 586. And then the words I'm going to show you, after the fall of Jerusalem, these words relate to a period 1 month after that. So 1 month after the fall of Jerusalem, when they were captured, we read these words in 2 Kings. On the seventh day of the fifth month, in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, an official of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. So he came after the battle was won. He set fire to the temple of the Lord, the royal palace and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down. The whole Babylonian army, under the command of the imperial guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, carried into exile the people who remained in the city, along with the rest of the populace and those who had deserted the king of Babylon. But the commander left behind some of the poorest people of the land to work the vineyards and fields. So the question is, what was left of Jerusalem? This is a city that has been literally razed to the ground. It's been burnt to the ground. It's been dismantled stone by stone to the ground. There is no more Jerusalem. All you've got is rubble. Bit of promise in rubble, but you've got rubble. And so this is the slide I was talking about. So just to recap, I don't know about you, do you find your Old Testament history comes and goes? Do you find it goes out of your mind? I do. So this is the third week. Okay, so Babylonians sack Jerusalem, 586. But then we have Cyrus, who came along with the Persian kingdom, and he was much more kind-hearted to the exiles, not just the Jewish exiles, to the exiles from all the nations they conquered. And so he issued a decree, which is actually recorded for us on this archaeological artifact, saying that the exiles could all return to their homelands. So with respect to the Israelites, Zerubbabel leads a return, the first wave, and they build the temple foundation and build the temple as well 20 years later. And then Ezra leads a second wave of exiles. And then Nehemiah leads a third wave in 445 BC. So we've heard in the past 2 weeks how Nehemiah prayed. He gained permission from King Artaxerxes to return to rebuild. Last week, Peter Teagle spoke to us about how he then inspected the walls, inspected the damage, and motivated the people to rebuild. And that brings us to chapter 3, which describes the actual rebuilding of the wall. Now, I'm going to start reading. I was going to say, put your hand up when you've heard enough. Or shout out. I've decided against that. But I will be reading your body language a little bit. So here we go. I'm just going to read a few sections from chapter 3, starting at verse 1. Eliashib the high priest and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. Sheep gate was probably called that because it's where they brought through the sacrificial animals, okay, to the temple, which is probably why the high priest did it with his priests. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hananel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zaccur, son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate, that's where they brought the fish from the Mediterranean and from the Sea of Galilee, okay? The fish gate, not a good place to hang around probably, was rebuilt by the sons of Hasnah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. That's a phrase that comes up a lot in Nehemiah 3, doors and bolts and bars. Nehemiah keeps saying it. Meremoth, son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired the next section. Little gap here then. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. Azael, son of Hahiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section, and Hanani, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Rephaiah, son of Hur, ruler of a half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section. Adjoining this, Jediah, son of Haramath. You realize these pronunciations are all correct, okay? Say it confidently, made repairs opposite his house, and Hattush, son of Hashabniah, it's a good name, Hashabniah, made repairs next to him. Shalom, son of Halahesh, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. Stop smiling. The valley gate's where Nehemiah began his night ride when he inspected the walls, was repaired by Hanun and the residents of Zenoa. They rebuilt it and put its doors with their bolts and bars in place. They also repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the dung gate. The dung gate was repaired by poor Malkijah, son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth-Hakkerem. He rebuilt it, and guess what? He put its doors with their bolts and bars in place. Well, I could go on. Oh, by the way, the dung gate led into the Valley of Hinnom, And the name for the Valley of Hinnom is Gehenna. And it's that rubbish dump where they were throwing the rubbish. So it's constantly burning. That's the image Jesus used to talk about hell, that place of destruction where the fire is burning. So that's the dung gate. Now, there are another 18 verses, but do you want me to carry on? Okay, it's not in my notes. It was an empty question. But anyway, here's a map showing the section that I've just read. All the stuff in the yellow box, starting on the right-hand side here with the sheep gate. No, left-hand side, top, sheep gate. going all the way around to the Dungate. Unfortunately, that map isn't facing north, so this is actually the right way around. Can you see that just about? So basically, the sheep gate now is top right. Okay, so you can see it top right over there. And Nehemiah has just described the rebuilding of the wall anti-clockwise, and he got all the way around the top there to the dung gate. Right, and there were some 40 groups that were involved. Why? Why is this in the Bible? Well, if it tells us one thing, it reminds us this account is thoroughly historical. This isn't legend. This is real history. In fact, in 2007, there was an archaeologist called Dr. Eilat Mazar. He led an excavation team in Jerusalem, and they found part of Nehemiah's wall. And they noticed, when they found it, they said it wasn't brilliantly put together. It was had the appearance of being built in something of a hurry, which fits the text fantastically. And they also found a lot of Persian pottery there, which, of course, they would have all brought from Persia with them when they came back. Now, the section that was excavated was next to a stepped area, and that stepped area is described in Nehemiah 3, verse 15. It talks in verse 15 of the steps going down from the city of David, and here they are. Here are the steps at the southwest end of the city, I think. This was taken in the late 1800s, and here is that same thing today. This was taken in 2007, and here is a section of Nehemiah's wall. And around there, they found the pottery. Okay? If we come back to the text, I'm going into chapter 4 just briefly. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. And then chapter 6, 15, so the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. 52 days. And it would have looked something like this. Someone had a lot of fun, didn't they, making this model? But it would have looked a lot like that. And in fact, the original wall around the city of David was much bigger and went around the top of all these houses you can see in the top left corner. But they pulled the wall right in, so it's quite narrow there. But that is Nehemiah's wall. So, it is of historical interest, but is it just of historical interest? And the answer, of course, is no, because you didn't come for a history lesson. There are some fabulous truths in Nehemiah 3. Simple, but profound. So, here's the first one. All the people worked, almost. They didn't have expert builders like Duncan or Yuri or others here who have been involved in building. The building was rather amateurish. Reminds me of a story I heard a long time ago, and apologies if you heard this before, but it was a story of an old bricklayer who was hurt whilst fixing the top of a building, and he got badly hurt, and he had to write a sick note to his boss, and this is what he said. I arrived at the job after the storm and saw that the top of the building needed repairs. I rigged a hoist and boom, attached the rope to a barrel and pulled the bricks up to the top in several loads. When I pulled the barrel to the top, I secured the rope at the bottom. After repairing the top of the building, I filled the barrel with the leftover bricks. I climbed down and then released the rope to lower the bricks. However, the barrel was heavier than me and lifted me off the ground. I decided to hang on. Halfway up, I met the barrel coming down and received a blow to my shoulder. I hung on and went to the top, where I hit my head on the boom and caught my fingers in the pulley. In the meantime, the barrel hit the ground beneath me and burst open, throwing bricks all over. This made the barrel lighter than me, and I started down at high speed. Halfway down, I met the barrel coming up and received a blow to my shins. I continued down and fell on the bricks, receiving cuts and bruises. At this time, I must have lost my presence of mind because I let go of the rope. And the barrel came down and hit me on the head. I respectfully request sick leave. Nehemiah would have been lucky to have someone like that. He would have been lucky and blessed to have an amateur builder like that. But you know who he had? He had priests, Levites, temple servants, goldsmiths, merchants, officials, masters, servants, men and women. I don't see any evidence in chapter 3 of anyone with any real building skill, quite frankly. What about verse 8, that perfume maker? You know, but he must have been out of his comfort zone a little bit. But there's one thing these people could all do. They could all put one stone on top of another. Yeah? They could all do that. They could all put a stone on top of another. And so they did. And God calls us without exception. He calls us without exception to be doing that for him. Putting one stone on top of another. In fact, it's not just that as God builds his kingdom, he wants us to be building with those stones. God calls us as stones. He's building with us. He's using us as the building. And so we have these lovely words in 1 Peter chapter 2. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. So that's a challenge for us. Are we building? Or can God use us for his building? You know, are we building God's kingdom? Are we building his kingdom in our homes? Is that a place of God that knows God's truth and God's spirit and God's love and peace? Are we building God's spirit in our work context? Because we bring something of the fragrance of Christ to those people that encounter us in the workplace. Are we building God's kingdom in our friendship circles? Because we don't just go along with the spirit of our times, but we make a stand for God with truth and also with graciousness. Are we building for God in and through this church and its many activities, or through other Christian ministries that we're involved with? Let me just have a glass of water and then. Ephesians 4 says, instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. From him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. We've used this verse a few times here because what struck us was that last phrase, as each part does its work. Are we doing our part? There's one sad verse in chapter 3, just one, and that is people who didn't build. Did you hear who they were? The nobles of Tekoa. They wouldn't build. Apparently it was beneath them. They didn't want to get their hands dirty by getting involved in the physical labor. But you know what? For all the disgrace of the nobles of Tekoa, it was more than made up for by another group called the people of Tekoa. You see, the people of Tekoa, here's the wall, the wrong way around, and see, they built this section down here, but then they ran over, well, you know, and they also built that section there. The people of Tekoa built two sections. I find that really thrilling. I wonder if they said, you know what, our nobles, they won't work, but we will work, and we will do two sections of this wall. It's great. And that reminds me, you know, that often, and I think this is true up and down the country, that often one of the issues that churches face is that the majority of work can be being done by a small sort of overworked core. You know, because if we don't do our part of the building, somebody else will have to perhaps do more, maybe do double. So my challenge is, are we in the building business? I passed a church once and it had a big billboard, Master Carpenter Requires Joiners. You know, Jesus was into building, maybe not with stone, but certainly built with wood. And he requires joiners to join him in that business of building the kingdom. It might mean, yes, that you invest your time and gifts here, It may be that you're investing your time and gifts elsewhere through some other avenue, Christian avenue of service or serving God through your work, and you come here to get fed and nourished. That's fine. But God is building his kingdom. So we have a choice. We can be the nobles of Tekoa who are watching or the people of Tekoa who are building. And I'm sure we want to be the latter. So that's the first point. All the people worked, almost. Secondly, they worked as a team. I came across this picture this week on the internet, and of course everything you see on the internet is true, so I thought I'd share it with you. This is a wolf pack. The wolves leading there apparently are the oldest and the sickest. And the oldest and the sickest in the wolf pack apparently set the pace. They are followed by that group of five wolves in yellow there. They are the strongest wolves in the pack, and their job is to follow those three and to look after them and to protect them. At the back, you've got another box of five with the green box. They are also amongst the strongest, and their job is to protect that middle group. Who do you think's at the back? The leader. The leader's at the back, making sure that no one is left behind. That's wonderful, isn't it? The wolf pack, working as a team. And the natural world is full of animals and species that work as a team. Geese work as a team with their long migratory flights, and I'd love to preach a sermon on geese. I've done it four times before, but not here. But I'm not going to inflict my geese sermon on you. Ants. James, you preached about ants, didn't you? And the amazing way in which they coordinate as a team to find and gather food and then go looking for more food. Is Jolt here? Jolt? There you are. Jolt used to be a keeper of bees. We've got some honey at home. And he knows, and Iboya knows, how bees work together as a team to provide that food source to get them through the winter or make honey. They work as a team. Now, we have our youth in today, so I want you to complete this slogan, okay? Teamwork makes the... Yay! Teamwork makes the dream work. And Nehemiah 3 is surely one of the finest examples of Israelite brotherhood and sisterhood. 40 groups working side by side without envy, without rivalry, without snobbery. If you remember Brother Andrew, he loves Nehemiah 3. And he underlined in chapter 3 a three-word phrase, which is repeated 14 times. And that phrase is, next to him, next to him, next to him. And sometimes it says next to them as well. And he said that's the rhythmical song of teamwork. Side by side. Now, all of this must have taken huge amounts of organization and administration and delegation. Who's not mentioned, do you think, in Nehemiah 3? Yeah, Nehemiah. Actually, he is, but it's not him. It's another Nehemiah in verse 16. The leader is not mentioned. And I think that's very deliberate. I think that's how Nehemiah wanted to write this chapter, because the focus here is not on the leader, it is on the team. You know, this chapter is not about, oh, all praise to Nehemiah who can do the job of 10 men. It's, wow, we're rejoicing because 10 men are doing the job, and women, daughters as well. So this is all about the team. But leaders are mentioned. In fact, the first person mentioned who picked up his trowel was the high priest in verse 1. And then we're told in chapter 4:21, Nehemiah says that we worked, I presume that included himself, from the first light of dawn until the stars came out. And in chapter 4:23, he says that we worked, we didn't take our clothes off during that time. Perfumer must have been gutted to not be able to be in business. They worked hard, and they worked as a team. Some of it wasn't glamorous. Malkijah drew the short straw, as I said. He worked on the dung gate. Other people got to work on the wall of the Pool of Siloam by the King's Garden. There was a bit of self-interest in the building. If you notice, some of the people built the wall next to their house. Now, I don't know about you, but I would feel awfully motivated to build a bit of the wall next to my house. Nehemiah was okay with that. He worked with that degree of self-interest or self-preservation. But also, we read that some people came from outside. People like those from Jericho and Mizpah and Gibeon. Gibeon, David captured Jerusalem from the Gibeonites in the first place and made it its capital. But here, the Gibeonites are coming to help rebuild Jerusalem. And they worked. They worked as a team. And they finished the job. You know, if one of that group of 40 have said, oh, you know what, I've had it. We're out of here. They would have had a great wall with a huge back door through which any army could have walked. So it's important that we're doing our bit as we build God's kingdom. But it's not just about doing our bit. It's about doing our bit together as a team, cooperating together in all our, you know, because we're all different. We all bring different things. And when we gather together, there is a sense in which we dovetail and we complement, and something very special, God can do something very special amongst us in those moments. HBC is a sight to behold, isn't it, James? On a good day with the team. If you want to see HBC at its best, I believe, this would be my opinion, come to the Holiday Club in the summer. Come to the Holiday Club. You will find a smooth, slick machine. It works so well. Everybody seems to know their place. Working side by side for 5 long, tiring days, but it's fabulous. Ben's already talked about Sunday mornings. You know, I think we have 10 or so rotas in operation. 10 rotas. Just to make Sundays happen. But it works. You know, we come in on a Sunday, we don't think, oh, there'll be no one at the door, or there'll be no one playing in the band. You know, it works because we work as a team. If I can change from the building to a body, I know that's a bit confusing, but 1 Corinthians 12, if you remember, it says we're many parts, but we form one body. The foot needs the hand, the ear needs the eye. It says in verse 27, you are the body of Christ, and each one of you is a part of it. You are a part of the body. Just need to ask yourself, what's my part? What's my place in the body here? What is it God is asking me to do? Finally, they worked hard. We read that the people worked with all their heart. And one individual is singled out for special mention in verse 20. I didn't get to verse 20, and that's Baruch. We're told he worked zealously. And that word zealously in Hebrew means to glow or to grow warm. He was working hard. He was sweating. And God wants us to work hard for him. I am not talking about becoming overworked, stressed out church members. We all know a little bit of stress is good for us. A lot of stress over a long time is very, very damaging for us. I don't think God wants us to live with constant stress. But there is such a thing as healthy hard work. Yes? Healthy hard work. There is such a thing. And lots of people work hard. You know, I came on Friday to collect my girls after youth. Turns out they'd already left. I miss them, but... And I was just chatting to Zoe and Abby in the kitchen there. I think one or two of the team were around, maybe one or two had left. But they work hard. You know, Friday night, it's the end of the working week, when I think our instinct is, I've worked hard, I want to rest. I want to do something for me. But they come on a Friday night and they serve at what I think is the hardest night of the week. And they've been doing that faithfully. What about our Light Bite group, who... have some of our Light Bite team have been for decades, perhaps, working in that kitchen to provide lunches for our elderly. And those elderly people, if you ask them, Light Bite is an absolute central point of their week. They love it. They meet friends. And that team has been working hard. Toddlers working hard on Tuesday mornings. There are so many. You could list so many. We're told... in Ecclesiastes 9:10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. And then Colossians 3, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. So what I want to say is spirituality is not a substitute for sweat. I'll say it again. Spirituality is not a substitute for sweat. We need spirituality, but we also sometimes need the sweat. We need to work hard. You see, because in the story of Nehemiah, all of his fasting and praying and vision and boldness and planning and administration would have counted for almost nothing had the people not worked hard. They needed to do that. We got these words from 1 Corinthians chapter 3. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If anyone builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, their work will be shown for what it is, because today we'll bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each person's work. If what has been built survives, the builder will receive a reward. If it is burned up, the builder will suffer loss, but yet will be saved, even though only as one escaping through the flames. So which ones survive the fire? The gold? The silver? And the precious stones? Which ones wouldn't survive the fire? Yeah, right. So it's just a challenge here from God's word. What are we building with? What are we building with? Are we working for God? Are we working as a team, working hard for God? So that what we do for him will survive that purifying fire of God? Or are we not building? Or are we building half-heartedly? Are we building out of wrong motivation? Are we building not drawing from God's Spirit, who has to be our resource, but actually trying to do it ourselves? I need to finish, so let me just put the 3 points back up. They all worked, almost. Are we working on our bit? God doesn't ask us to build the whole wall. He just says, this is your bit. This is your bit. You do that. Don't worry about it. You do this. Are we doing that? Are we working with others as a team so that what we do is completed? And are we working hard with all our heart? Because we're not just building the physical walls of Jerusalem. We are building the eternal walls and the everlasting walls of the kingdom of God. I want to finish by just mentioning something that happened to me 9 days ago. I led a graveside committal for Doug Holvey. Now, Doug Holvey, one or two of you know him, he was an absolute pillar of the work down in Northway Church for 40 or 50 years. There were times in Doug's life where he was running youth groups 3 nights of the week. He was all over that building doing stuff practically. And when he got too old, they said, you can't do it anymore, Doug. You can't go up ladders and paint. So he did it when no one was looking. He worked hard. And I read these words at his funeral. It says, therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. And you see, I could read those words at Doug's funeral, and everybody there knew that that was true. Not just a little bit true, but that was true of him. He worked hard for the Lord, and it wasn't in vain. And I was just left thinking, and I talked with Peter and Lynette about this afterwards, I was just left thinking, I wonder when I die if somebody might read that verse, and if they did, if people would say, yeah, that was Chris, or if they would pick another verse instead. It challenged me. I've got about 15 or whatever years or longer to get there. But it's a challenge. And I would love those verses to be able to be said of me. Chris worked hard for the Lord. And it would be great, wouldn't it, if those could be said over each one of our lives. Worked hard for the Lord. Thanks, Ben.